Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you all today. Nicholas Freudenberg will be joining me. He's a distinguished professor at the public health at City University of New York Graduate School. And he'll be coming on in a little bit. But first, I want to share with you things going on in and around the news, ways that you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. Well, today is Earth Day, which usually every year on Earth Day, I'm busy doing some cooking demo somewhere. But this year, all is quiet on the home front. Actually, I was going to join a free screening of a film called The Seeds of Adana Shiva tonight. Today's the last day to watch this free film. It's a full-length documentary film. And Vandana Shiva is a real amazing activist. She's an eco-activist. And this is about her life story. And I've been a big fan. I've interviewed Vandana Shiva. I've heard her speak many times. And she's really fighting back against genetically modified foods, genetically modified seeds, and the modification of foods as a commodity. And so I'm really excited to check that out. So I encourage you all to go online and look for The Seeds of Vandana Shiva and watch that. Today's the last day that you can actually watch that for free. Also, Kiss the Ground, another wonderful documentary, is being offered. Last night, Slow Food Hofstra showed it, and they had a Q&A following. So look for that online as well. As far as take action and in the news, I mean, we all heard on Tuesday that the verdict came in for George Floyd, and I think everybody had a big sigh of relief in hearing that the officer was actually convicted of murder. It doesn't bring George Floyd back, nor does it bring all the other people of color who have lost their lives at the hands of police, but it is a reckoning that we all have to deal with about systemic racism in our society and what we can do about it and how the police are gonna really take a hard look at the way they conduct business and how they treat other human beings. And it's, long overdue, but I know we all had a big sigh of relief when that came out. The New York Times this week in the science section came out with a great article on climate change. And I suggest everybody get a hold of it. I put a link on my website to the article, but it just answers so many questions that people have about, about climate change and, the big questions, what was the record heat? What's happening with the oceans and absorbing the heat? All the questions that we want to know: are humans really responsible for creating climate change? Is it caused by humans? Since greenhouse gases occur naturally, how do we know that the Earth temperature is really rising? I mean, so many questions that people have. This is a full section just on climate change. And, I have to say that I'm really excited that our current administration is actually taking up climate change as a real issue. We've lost, 4 years with the past administration in denial, and we have a lot of catch up to do. So I'm really glad to see that happening, and it's just, long overdue. So, we all need to look at, what we can do on a personal level as well. And I'm sure I'll be talking about that with my guest in a little bit. There's a take action link on my website as well to support New York Health. And to support the New York Health Act. And we really need to find ways to deal with healthcare and make it affordable. Right now, I know, my income certainly was cut during COVID, and I went on to Obamacare websites to look for health insurance, and it still was unaffordable. I did not qualify for any subsidies, and yet the amount that I have to pay feels really unaffordable. So it's really something that we have to look at. Too many Americans do not have health care, and it's a real issue. So that is something that you can take some action on, and I really encourage you to do that. I want to share with you this week's recipe, which is a real simple recipe, but I had a lot of beets this week, and I cooked some up, and I wanted to make a beet and walnut salad. I actually shredded the beets, and I think if I do it again, I might actually try dicing the beets, because when you shred them and you mixed it, I mixed it in with the walnut paste that I'll be telling you about in a minute. It, you know, took on a very muddy color, and I think if I dice the beets the next time, it might actually have a brighter color. But anyway, I used 2 medium-sized beets. It was about 1 pound in total. 1.5 cups of walnut halves, 3 cloves of garlic, but 2 to 3 cloves would be good. 1 tablespoon of pomegranate vinegar. You could also use red wine vinegar if you don't have pomegranate vinegar. 1 teaspoon of lemon juice just to make the flavors pop a little bit. 1/2 cup of packed cilantro leaves and 1/2 cup of packed parsley leaves. 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon of ground coriander. And I also used 1/2 teaspoon of Camellia sunnii spice, which is a Georgian spice, a mixture. If you don't have that, you can use fenugreek or cardamom, you know, something like that. Or even cumin would be good. But Camellia sunnii spice is really wonderful, and you can find it online. And I have a link on my website to that. Freshly ground pepper and some pomegranate seeds for garnish. So you're going to cook the beets. Either you can boil them, roast them, steam them, however you'd like to get them tender. They take about 45 minutes. And then let them cool down a bit. While they're cooking, in a food processor, you're going to pulse the cilantro, the parsley, the walnuts, and the garlic, and set that aside. And when the beets are cool enough to handle, I grated them. And like I said, next time I might try to dice them really small. And you're going to mix the grated beets with the walnut paste and season it with the vinegar, the lemon juice, and the spices, and then taste it. If you want to add a little more salt or a little bit more spice, you can. Refrigerate it for about 1 hour before serving, just to allow the flavors to come together. And I garnished it with some pomegranate seeds and some fresh cilantro, and it was absolutely yummy, yummy. So I recommend you all give that a try. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you, my guest this week is Nicholas Freudenberg. He is the Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the City University of New York Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy, where he also directs the CUNY Urban Food Policy Institute. And they put out a great newsletter that I recommend you all sign up for. I get lots of information from that. I've invited him on to talk about his most recent book, At What Cost? Modern Capitalism and the Future of Health. And in this book, he explains how globalization, financial speculation, monopolies, and control of science and technology have allowed corporations and their allies to influence our government and policies, and how that affects our ability to make real choices. And it's a real, you know, real important issue. We all think when we go to the supermarket, we have all these choices. The supermarkets are filled with so many aisles of food choices. But when it really comes down to it, only a few big corporations own all these different companies. And so it's my pleasure now to introduce all of you to Nicholas. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking today.
Great. Well, same here. But I wanted to just start, if you could share with us a little bit about your history, like how did you get on this path? Just share with us.
So I'm an aging 60s activist. I was active in the student anti-war movement and the environmental movement. And I became a public health researcher because I thought understanding the links between health and social justice would enable us to make progress towards creating a healthier, more livable, more sustainable world. And I've been working primarily in New York for several decades. A lot of my work is with community organizations and municipal institutions to develop, implement, and evaluate interventions that will improve community health and reduce some of the really stark inequalities between better off and lower income population and between Black and Latinx and other populations and white folks. And one of the things I noticed in doing this work, both with our community partners and with city and town governments, and with some of the activist organizations, is in almost every case, we would come up against some corporate interests. And whether I was working on pollution or access to food or tobacco and alcohol, somewhere it was very frequent that corporate interests who were looking to promote their profits and increase their control would look to stymie, to undermine public health efforts. And so for the last long period, I've been trying to understand, how does that happen? You know, how do corporations and the political and economic system that they represent influence health? And then what can we as community residents, as citizens, as taxpayers, as parents, as health professionals do to minimize the harm from corporations? And that is the path that led me to this book, At What Cost?
Yeah, let's talk about the book. It's a fascinating book. It's something I've certainly been aware of, you know, as a promoter of school food and someone who actually goes into the cafeteria to try to make school food healthier. You know, I saw the pushback with Michelle Obama's, you know, let's get healthy. I mean, you know, who would even think that there's lobbyists just for frozen pizza or lobbyists for frozen French fries? I mean, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous. And the power that they have to push back against a school health lunch program that is going to help so many young people. And so, you know, I really started seeing the power of lobbying, you know, so long ago. And in your book, you really touch on that. Can you tell us about your book a little bit and capitalism and the future of our health?
Sure. So I think, you know, in the last few years, we have seen this cascade of apocalypses, you know, of threats to public health. Clearly, the COVID-19 pandemic is the current example, but we've also seen the climate emergency. We've seen the rise of what have been called deaths of despair, the increasing rates of death among less educated, including white working class populations related to opioids and alcohol and tobacco and firearms and workplace injuries. We've seen the huge burden of chronic diseases, non-communicable diseases, and a lot of my work has been focused on dietary diseases like diabetes and cardiovascular disease and increasingly a number of types of cancer. And I think as we look at these, at this cascade of public health crises, we see that there's some underlying causes. And I believe that increasingly the political and economic system that I call modern capitalism or 21st century capitalism has become increasingly toxic, increasingly incompatible with human and planetary health. And I think others have pointed out this systemic problem, but what I try to do in the book is to connect it to the daily lives of ordinary people. And in the book, I suggest that we depend on six pillars of health: food, healthcare, education, work, transportation, and social connections. And in each of these essential foundations of health, corporations and their allies have made it harder for people to get what they need to maintain their well-being and the well-being of their families. And so that puts on public health the question, well, what can we do about this? And picking up on the example you started with of talking about food. In one of the chapters, I look at the rise of the global ultra-processed food industry. And these are the, you know, two dozen or so global corporations, from Pepsi and Coca-Cola to Walmart to McDonald's to Archer Daniels, the agricultural commodities company, that really control the global food systems. And what this sector of the industry has found is that ultra-processed foods, foods that go through industrial processes, foods that are high in fat, salt, sugar, as well as hundreds of additives, flavorings, stabilizers, and other products, that diet is more profitable than the diet that humans evolved with over the millennia, that includes more fresh and minimally processed food. And there's a growing body of scientific evidence that this ultra-processed diet, which now constitutes more than half the calories Americans consume every year, that this ultra-processed diet is closely associated with the rise of diet-related diseases, such as the diabetes and cancer and cardiovascular disease. And so the diet that is good for business for the food industry is now become the leading contributor to premature deaths and preventable illnesses in the United States and also around the world. And so it's this contradiction between what's good for the food business and what's good for the American people or the world's people that I try and point out. And then the question becomes, of course, so what can we do about this? And I look for ways to bring together those people who are working on food, on healthcare, on work, to develop a common agenda that will allow us to have a more unified voice in the complex political terrain of the United States today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, greed is the driving factor here. And it's, you know, I don't know what the solution is. I mean, I was shocked. You know, I've been aware of these connections for so many years as well. And yet I was shocked to actually learn about the connection that these food companies and diet companies, Nestle, Pepsi, that they also invest in diet companies. I, you know, heard about Michael Moss's new book, you know, Hooked, talking about the sugar. And he was talking about how these big companies that are pushing all the fattening foods also are investing in diet companies so that they're making profit on both ends, on you right. getting
well,
fat.
Well, that's the ethic of 21st century capitalism. Hedge your bets, you know, don't do anything. Don't, you know, make sure no matter what happens, your profits are assured. But I think the point about the diet foods that Pepsi-Cola, I mean, Pepsi a decade ago talked about three different categories of food. Good for you, you know, there are products like bottled water and fruit juices, you know, maybe not actually so good for you. And then on the opposite side were the fun for you products like sugary beverages. And in the middle were sort of better for you products. And what they said is, we stand for choice. We're offering our customers choice. But the reality was that the bulk of their profits and sales came from their unhealthy products. And that's where they put their marketing muscle. They engaged, you know, in what some of us now call predatory marketing, marketing unhealthy products to vulnerable populations, to children, to Black and Latinx communities. And our children are overwhelmingly exposed to food advertising that is mostly unhealthy. Where our children learn most about food is not from their schools, not from their parents, but from television and the social media. And overwhelmingly, those messages are promoting unhealthy food. So yes, Pepsi offers choices, but the choices they offer are only the ones that assure their profits. And those are not the choices that assure a healthy population or a healthy world for our children and grandchildren.
Right, right. In the book, you also mention 9 lessons for activists. You want to share those with us?
Sure. I think as someone who's studied and read about the movements for change that I've witnessed in my lifetime, from the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, more recently, Black Lives Matter, the anti-gun violence, Dreamers, I think there's some lessons we can learn from the successes and limitations of those movements that can inform a more powerful response to the corporate onslaught on health. And the first, I think, is to look for choosing issues and framing issues that bring together groups working across different sectors. And I talked in the book about the Green New Deal as an example of that, a movement that brings together the vital importance of creating new jobs, good jobs that pay a living wage and offer benefits, reducing the carbon emissions and the greenhouse gas emissions that are threatening the well-being of current and future generations, and also growing healthier food. That's an example of a collaboration that offers a much more powerful voice. And just in the next few weeks, a new iteration of the Green New Deal is going to be introduced in Congress that will enable activists and social movements to again advance that forward. So the first lesson is look for common ground. The second lesson is not to make the incremental changes and the transformative changes in opposition to each other. I've seen so many debates in the movements that I've studied and participated in between, well, should we be emphasizing incremental changes or should we be looking for, you know, the bigger, more transformative ones? And my belief is that that's the wrong debate to have. We need both. And what we need to be asking is, how do we find incremental changes that lead to transformative changes? How do we change the school lunch program in small and medium-sized ways today so that tomorrow all our institutional food programs in schools, childcare centers, senior centers, hospitals will be contributing to a healthy food system? So that is a second lesson. A third lesson that I think very sharply accentuated is to really put front and center the stratification systems, particularly systemic racism, that the corporate system uses to divide opponents and critics of it. That over the last 200 or 300 years, the various forms of capitalism that have evolved in the United States have been closely linked to systemic racism. And both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X talked about the connections between racism and capitalism. And if we allow, and this is particularly true for white communities, both middle class and working class communities, if we allow racism to divide people who are being harmed by the overall economic and political system, it will always be the corporations that are able to maintain control. And so putting front and center in our movements the needs and the voices of those who are most harmed by current policies, whether it's predatory marketing of unhealthy products, whether it's the employment practices in the precarious economy and the gig economy that consistently harm Black and Latinx communities and Native Indian communities more than whites, We need to be putting those front and center to build a unified, coordinated movement. So those are a few of the lessons that I think we need to incorporate into our daily practice if we're going to be successful in improving health.
That was three.
Yes, I can talk about more. I wanted to make sure
to
see if you had other questions. Another point I discuss at some length in the book is that over the last few decades, the science and technology that have the potential to improve human health and the sustainability of our world are increasingly being controlled by the corporations that are dominant in our economy. And even when those technologies have the potential to benefit human health, clearly the coronavirus vaccine, that's a good thing. But when it is Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca that control the pricing and distribution of those vaccines, we see that the access to them perpetuate those stratifications that I was just talking about. And we also see that people living in low and middle income countries are much less likely to have access to vaccines than the better off populations. We also see it in the development of autonomous vehicles, technology which could really transform our transportation systems. But as long as it is the automobile industry and big tech that is in control of that technology, that they will use it to maximize their profits, even if that ends up undermining human health and the environment. And so I think the movements have to look for a aggressive strategy of wresting back control of science and technology into the public sector, in people. And that involves patent laws where discoveries that were generated by taxpayer dollars to universities should belong to the public that paid for them, not to the individual corporations that buy the patents and then profit from them and deploy them in ways that hurt health. And we see these same issues in the food industry where the genetic blueprints of some of our crops are owned by companies and used to maximize their profits rather than to think about how is a way to use our deeper understanding of how food grows and what supports it to benefit human health and protect the environment rather than simply to increase corporate profits.
Yeah, well, there's also the problem because these corporations make big donations to universities that are doing the research. And that has a big influence also on what research actually gets publicized, right? They can choose, they basically own the research and they can choose what to publicize and what not. You know, and when you also talk about profits, you know, with our health, I mean, I was just recently reading an article about, you know, the universities that get reimbursed by Medicaid for cesareans have a much higher cesarean rate at the hospitals than, you know, than other universities that don't get to bill Medicaid. And, you know, just there was a great film called, you know, The Business of Being Born, you know, which is all about the profit that's made around giving birth and why cesareans are so popular in this country because of all the profit that's made with it. So it's really such a huge issue. I mean, in every single aspect of our lives, I mean, even, you know, vaccinations, I mean, it's, you know, profit driven, you know, and that's why there's so much skepticism in it.
I think your examples of, you know, the way that profit distorts healthcare are really apt. And I talk about that in the book some. I look particularly at the at cancer and how the profit motive and for-profit companies have distorted cancer care and certainly minimized what we applying what we know about prevention of cancer. But I think in the question of and the educational system also, as you were saying, has increasingly been penetrated by for-profit companies who see it as a new profit center, you know, as the profits from the manufacturing economy have declined. But in the question of patents, there are tools available, and we need elected officials who will exercise their existing power and enforce existing laws. Many of those discoveries were funded, as I said, by taxpayers, and the federal government needs to reclaim the patents that come from publicly supported dollars and set up a system where those discoveries are used to benefit the public rather than simply to generate profits. In those cases, the power exists, but it's not being utilized. And that's where I think social movements, the food movement, the healthcare for all movement, other movements can really together exercise our power to get Congress, to get President Biden, to begin to use the powers they already have to claim scientific discoveries made in the public sector for the public benefit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's all good. Absolutely. So let's go to five.
Good. So I think another important strategy for building a successful movement that can contribute to a healthier world is to emphasize the development of the next generation of leaders in the both as a researcher looking at the history of public health and as someone who has participated in movements. I've seen how young people and marginalized communities have been at the forefront of the efforts to improve public health for a long time. And some of us who are in more established or powerful positions have sometimes gotten used to being influential voices in making decisions about activism and the direction of movements. I think if we want to capitalize on the energy and enthusiasm of young people and those communities and populations that have been most harmed by the current system, we need to look for ways to share what we know with the up and coming leaders, to step back so that they can step forward, to share what we've learned. And this book is my effort to share what I've learned from a few decades of public health research and activism with those people. And I think every organization has to ask, who's going to take up this work next year and in the next decade? And what can we be doing to develop those leaders? I think that's an important strategy. And I think I'm concerned. I understand and respect the need to have sharp, clear debates about some of the issues confronting movements. But I fear that some of the negative parts of the cancel culture and the not being willing to engage in debates and confusing allies who we disagree with enemies who stand for everything we're opposed to, I think that really makes it harder to build a strong, unified movement. And together, we need to be talking about, within the movement, how do we address and acknowledge differences and resolve them to find common principled ground? And when is it principled to make compromises, because that will allow us to move forward? Those are hard discussions. There's no simple answer. But unless we're willing to put them on the table and create spaces where we can look at them, we will have trouble. I'm going to move on to another lesson that I believe, which is, I believe we need to start talking about capitalism. That I think for those of us who came of age in the last several decades, there was a real reluctance to use the word capitalism. I think we thought it would make us sound like relics from an earlier era, or, you know, immature young rebels who weren't yet seasoned. I think a lot of people were maybe afraid to use the word, that, you know, having seen what happened in the Cold War. But I think as a public health researcher, we need to understand the system that shapes patterns of health and disease. And I think increasingly in the 21st century, that system is global capitalism. It's a system that has multiple variants. It's not one thing. I don't think either in the scientific community or in the movement, we need to reach agreement on what brand of capitalism or socialism we're going to endorse. I think we will have differences about that, and we work those differences out in practice. But we do need to understand the system, and we need to study it, we need to talk about it, and we need to label it. And what I've learned from Black Lives Matter and from At Me Too and from other movements, if we don't label and name the systems of oppression, it is much harder to understand them and to take action to change them. In addition, and a kind of corollary of that, is we need to identify the ideas of capitalism. Capitalism is an ideological system as well as a political and economic system. And the corporations and their allies have spent a lot of money and political effort to promote a set of ideas. One of them is that it's mainly individuals who are responsible for their health. And anytime that people talk about public responsibility or social responsibility or corporate responsibility, they reply back, well, it's onto the individual to ensure that he or she stays healthy, or it's onto parents to protect the health of their children. And I think we need to really have what has always been a very American discussion of what's the balance between community responsibility and individual responsibility. And if corporations are asking individuals and families to be responsible, then they need to be asking, well, what does a responsible business organization do in this society? And what I can say very clearly it does not do is look to undermine parental authority. Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook are currently proposing to put out a new Instagram for children under 13, an example of a move in exactly the wrong direction. Why do they want to target their marketing to under 13-year-olds? Because they can evade parental oversight, because they can evade public oversight, and that they can use that to gather information to sell to food companies and alcohol companies and e-cigarette companies, data about our children that will help them to target marketing. Even if it's not for direct marketing, it's for the indirect marketing that are used to establish lifetime customers. So talking about responsibility is an important idea. Another really critical idea that capitalism promulgates is that there is no alternative to the current political and economic system. Maggie Thatcher in the United Kingdom, Ronald Reagan here in the United States promoted that idea that the current form of capitalism is the only way the world can organize. But really, that's hogwash. Looking at the last century, there have been a whole variety of forms of economic and political organization, even within capitalism. Look at Scandinavia, look at Europe, look at some of the Central American countries, many varieties. We need to be exploring what are the arrangements, the social and political arrangements that best protect human health, enable people to achieve their aspirations. And I think it's become increasingly clear that the current arrangements of 21st century capitalism are not enabling that to happen. So we need to be looking for alternatives. And that notion that there are no alternatives is a disabling idea, and it's deliberately promoted to discourage people from seeking alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you know, one of the things that your book does in raising the awareness to the next generation, to younger people, is to raise their awareness about how they're being manipulated, because that's one thing that young people do not like to be, is manipulated.
Yes.
And, you know, they don't want to be taken advantage of. They don't want to think someone has, you know, has an upper hand on them. And so it's a great way of inspiring them to want to take up this fight, is to let the, you know, is to really pull back the curtain and say, look at what's really going on.
Right. And to give you an example of that, at the CUNY Urban Food Policy Institute, which I direct, based at the CUNY School of Public Health, we've had a program for the last several years of training young people to be what we call unhealthy food counter marketers. And so young people who have grown up in the neighborhoods where our school is located, in Central and East Harlem and the South Bronx, come to us after having gotten interested in food activism. And we work with them to create counter marketing campaigns for the products that are so relentlessly and ubiquitously promoted in their communities. You know, Pepsi, Coke, McDonald's, Baby Shark cereals. And what we found is...
Do they have that? Do they have a Baby Shark cereal now?
There is a Baby Shark cereal developed by Kellogg's.
Oh, no.
From that song. And hundreds of millions of 2 to 4 year olds have been exposed to the social media campaigns of Baby Shark using that song. And it's clear example of how Kellogg and other food companies look to get underneath parental oversight to convince young children to nag their parents. And Marion Nessel has written very movingly about the campaigns, the Kellogg campaign for Baby Shark. You can look at her website to get more details.
Okay, about I will.
High in sugar, totally unhealthy, and relentlessly marketed to two-year-olds. And what they do by that as well, it's not only the sugar and other additives, preservatives, flavorings that those 2 years take in, but it also establishes a lifetime predilection for these unhealthy products that don't require a lot of chewing, that make it harder to, you know, eat fresh, healthy food. So it's really ubiquitous.
I'm sorry to interrupt. You know, at the same time, I think these food companies, as we know, you know, these big corporations also own the small healthy food companies because they've bought them all up. And it seems like the healthy food industry is one of the fastest growing segments of the food market. Why, if they're coming out with a new cereal that they're marketing to kids, knowing that people are caring about their health, why not go the healthy route? Why not use this opportunity to market, you know, this new cereal and make it healthy? I don't get it. Why not?
See, I think that gets to the heart of what we were talking about earlier, of the logic of the ultra-processed food industry, which is really the logic of 21st century capitalism. And they have, the global food industry has created an infrastructure around the world. They have persuaded, convinced, coerced farmers into growing through large-scale agriculture, the corn, soy, sugar, palm oil, rice, that are the staples for the ultra-processed diet. They've set up huge production facilities. They've organized a workforce that they often pay sub-minimum wages and offer inadequate benefits. And so they've created an infrastructure. They've invested billions of dollars in creating that infrastructure, allied with the fertilizer industry, the pesticide industry, the food distribution industry. So to create an alternative industry that would put healthy products front and center would require a very different kind of investment. And it's not simply a matter, as some, I think, misguided food activists suggest, of simply reformulating the products they make and putting in a little less sugar and a little less salt. Those would be good steps in the right direction. But I think what the scientific research is suggesting is it's the fact of ultra processing, the putting in all those products, the putting food through an industrial process that leads to the immunological and the gut microbiome and the hormonal changes that make ultra-processed food contribute to diabetes and cardiovascular disease mm-hmm. and cancer. And so we really need a different diet. And that will require a transformation of our food system. It's not going to happen overnight. And that is not something the food industry wants to see. So they buy up these small companies, just as you're describing, and they convert their products into something that they can make a profit on, you know, healthier processed foods rather than the minimally processed foods that would constitute, or the unprocessed foods that would constitute a healthy diet. And to make that transition, we will really need to rethink our agricultural system. We'll need to rethink how the USDA subsidizes farmers. We'll need to re-empower the many small and medium-sized farmers, including Black and Latino farmers, to give them a chance to develop what they're growing. But if we do that, the good news is that we'll also be sustaining farmland. We'll be reducing climate change. We'll be creating an agricultural system and a food system that has the potential to pay living wages. That's a long process, but you know, we start on that journey now. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come back to the unhealthy
to the
food
nine.
Because yeah. I think it illustrates how any school, any community organization can begin to take on these issues. So we train young people to develop social media campaigns, community campaigns, school images. You can go to the CUNY Urban Food Policy Institute website and see some of the images they've created to challenge the fun for you message of PepsiCo, or the, you know, open happiness message of Coca-Cola. The posters they developed for their Coca-Cola counter marketing message were open death, you know, and they used the same images that Coca-Cola had for open happiness and showed open death and talked about diabetes and heart disease. And what we found is that the 16 and 18 year olds who have gotten interested in food, that they have parents and uncles and aunts and grandparents and brothers and sisters with diabetes or hypertension. And so they're protecting their family's health, their own health, by counteracting these messages. And they're also becoming political activists and looking to encourage New York City to tax sugary beverages, to restrict marketing of unhealthy products, to improve the food in their schools, and they're educating their parents and their families in the same process. I think this is an example of the community mobilization that can begin the process of creating, you know, what I envision is a movement for well-being, a movement that brings together people concerned about food and healthcare and education and the climate. And that every one of us can make a contribution to building that movement.
Mm, absolutely. Your book does such a great job about bringing people into this fight, into, you know, into taking some control back, because we've lost control. And, you know, the decisions that are being made for the benefit of profit for the few is causing such havoc on every level of our society. It's just, you know, it's so hard to know where to start. And I think one of your best suggestions is just starting with those incremental changes, you know, start small. I mean, you start local, start, you know, and yet I'm sure you could say the same as I could, because we've been in it for so long, we have seen some change, right? We have seen more awareness. We have seen, you know, healthier food in regular supermarkets now. You don't only have to go to a Whole Foods to get healthy food. So there have been changes, slowly, but,
right.
But there have been some changes.
Another lesson that relates to the comment that you just made is something that we learned from the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s, which is their insight that the personal is political and the political is personal. And when we can connect the day-to-day experiences that so many people experience as a result of the corporate control of our economy and our politics and our society, like the young people we're working with who have family members affected by diabetes and heart disease. When you can connect those daily experiences to political activism, then people can become actors instead of victims. And all of us want to be healthy. All of us want our children and parents and grandchildren and the people we care about to be healthy. And by providing concrete pathways for people to translate that human desire to feel good and to be connected to other people into political activism, where you can start to make smaller changes and see them to lead to bigger changes, that is, in my mind, the pathway that will bring us to a healthier world. And people have always done that, right? This isn't something new, that we've seen huge advances in public health over the last century. And we've always seen that wealthy elites have challenged those advances. And so, you know, we have the opportunity to write the next chapter of that history of creating a healthier, more livable world.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're almost out of time, but I do want to touch on the sustainable diet approach, you know, the personal responsibility that people can take on, and whether you think that is a valid thing and that that's actually can make a difference or not. I mean, I know, you know, I've been vegetarian for over 40 years, but only in the last year really made the commitment to eat more plant-based solely, like, you know, and not, you know, to become vegan and not eat animal products for the welfare of the planet. What's your feeling about that?
Right. So I think, again, binaries, you know, saying that we choose this or that makes it more difficult to bring people into the movement that we need. And so I believe, again, we need to do both. We need to make changes in our personal lives, you know, to eat healthier food, to do more recycling and ways to drive less. I believe we can do those things, but we also need to become political activists. And each of us needs to figure out a combination of those things. I think what struck me from doing the research for my book is how much the options for our personal lives are constrained by the choices that corporations and their allies have made. So even someone determined to eat healthy, if they look at their resources and they look at what's available and affordable in their supermarket, will have a hard time doing that. Someone said to me, for a person with diabetes or pre-diabetes, eating healthy is a struggle every day. And so we need to both change the structural determinants that influence the choices that people have, and we need to be making healthier choices. And there's nothing to be gained by making people feel guilty about the choices they've made in the past.
Absolutely.
And there's everything to be gained by acting collectively to make sure that the healthy choice is the easy choice, you know? And in our world, too often, the easy choice is the unhealthy choice. And that's because that unhealthy choice is what brings profit to the giant corporations that currently control our politics and our economy. That's what we need to change. And we do it by what we do as individuals, and we do it especially by what we do as activists and organizers and community residents.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, because eating healthy does take more effort, more conscious. You can't just go into a fast food place. You can't go stop at a 7-Eleven and get something healthy. I mean, you know,
right.
The healthiest
thing. If
you
have to work two jobs to support your family, it's that much harder. And to put more responsibility on those people most harmed by the current system for making healthy choices, that's not fair. So what we need to do is to create, you know, the communities, the retail systems where all of us have easy access to healthy choices.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I think, you know, helping people with ways to prepare food. One of the things that I like to do, prepare foods, you know, with certain examples and tricks to make cooking and eating healthier, easier, you know? So, you know, I always talk about when I make brown rice, I don't make brown rice just for one night. I make brown rice for three meals and I freeze two of them. Or I put one in the freezer for a few days later and one in the refrigerator. I mean, one in the refrigerator for a few days later and one in the freezer for later in the week.
I'm looking forward to trying your beet and walnut salad.
So easy and so good. You know, so those tricks of, you know, making enough food, you make a casserole and freeze half of it so that you have a quick meal to take out the next time, because I'm very much aware that those that need to eat healthy, we all need to eat healthy, but so many of those that really need to make that change are working the two jobs and are in a lower economic environment where they really, you know, depend on fast food and quick food and cheap food to fill their stomachs.
Right.
And we need to make healthy food more accessible.
Right. And two simple examples that illustrate the public thinking to achieve those things. In Brazil, in some cities, local governments subsidize healthy food restaurants. The subsidies support local farmers, and anybody with, you know, even earning a minimum wage can find an affordable, healthy meal in those restaurants. Or if you look at some of the work that Jamie Oliver, the chef in the United Kingdom, has done, he does cooking classes for a whole community, and that then people prepare healthy food, but they prepare it for themselves and their neighbors and take turns doing that. Anything we can do to develop a shared responsibility for healthy food, that both connects people and also makes the healthy choices easier for all of us.
Yes, I love that. I've read about different communities, you know, sharing cooking. And I think that's just such a great thing. First off, especially if you're only cooking for a few people, it's hard to cook for a few people. It's easier to cook for a lot of people because, you know, you want to use a whole head of broccoli. You want to use a whole, you know, cauliflower. And so, you know, cooking and taking turns so that, and it's very easy to do that when you're in a city. It's a little more difficult if you're living more rurally where driving from one house to the next, you know, takes time. But, you know, in apartment buildings, you know, people take turns where, you know, it's one person's responsibility to cook every 4 days instead of every night, you know, really can take such pressure off people that have so much on their plate. So, you know, doing as much as we can cooperatively is certainly a benefit. Anyway, Nick, we're just about out of time. Can you share with everyone how they can find you if they want to plug in, ask any questions, and also your book?
Sure. I'm at the CUNY School of Public Health. My email is nick.freudenberg@sph.cuny.edu. That's nick.freudenberg@sph.cuny.edu. CUNY is C-U-N-Y. The book is published by Oxford University Press and is available on their website. And I look forward to hearing from your listeners.
And just a question, do you do a course based on your book?
This book came out of a course I've taught over the years with a colleague who's a historian of occupational health. And yes, we offer a course. It's called Corporations, Health, and Democracy. And I learned so much from my students, and some of their investigations for class assignments turned into work I developed in the book.
Well, it's great. Thank you so much for your work. Everyone, if you didn't get that info, I will be sharing it on my website too at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. So anyway, Nick, thank you so much. Thanks for your work. Thank you for inspiring all these young people to become activists, and keep it up.
Thank you, Bhavani, and thanks for having me and for your work too.
Sure. Everyone out there, have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.